That's number one.
Okay.
All the way down. Back to races.
Yeah, voice work and that. I couldn't remember. Yeah, it was the straightest of the races. Yeah.
Don't make it hard.
Hey, just want to double check if you got my.
It's all automatic. Once it gets assigned to
you, do I?
My PowerPoint.
No.
I emailed it to you.
You emailed it to me. I got it in my email, okay. But I will.
You want to put it on thumb drive?
if that's convenient, that would be really cool. Just drop it in that folder right there.
Yeah, okay.
Why do you keep emailing me stuff at night? I just.
Yeah, I get it.
Look, I guess they think I'm just a waste of you just maybe
do that. Well, you said it works. I mean, I'm bad about it.
You don't email me because you know what you need to bring.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Just like show up, you know, with another thumb drive. Like, no email. Because we don't always have reliable internet.
I'm not checking my email at 11:30 on. I'm just not. Okay.
They've got a time lapse.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
that's
why
we did our own video. Oh, talking trash about being you. No, I was just in the post office. I was so good to see you.
One of the issues that we were in recently, so much pressure for the senior managers on this board. When the most recent sandbags were installed, there was a scouting at the 13th class in the summer.
Dressed to the nines.
I can see at that time I can see this. So that's likely to have an effect on this channel. Probably the last to be landed.
I need some electricity.
Make sure you put it on the town government, you know, here in the
This one will probably be abandoned.
Just open it up. David Zerline. And is there anything I need to do to check in? Or I signed the sheet.
You are all set then. That's it. Yes. Thank you. Good to see you.
Well, so you don't smoke?
No.
I think I knew that. Should I have known that?
Yeah, because I've had to buy those before when I can't.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I grabbed a gas station while I was there.
Thank you.
There really wasn't any setup for this.
It's more than that?
Yeah. Maybe we'll have a June. I can't go by my initials.
You can't walk.
I wouldn't be able to go by my initials.
You wouldn't just be MJ.
I would be MJ, but that's Spider-Man's girlfriend.
Did that bother you a little bit?
I couldn't have people call me MJ.
Road three, straight across off the far side. It's like a little bit on the road.
Yeah, because like
Renee Cahoon.
Present, no conflicts.
Neil Andrew.
Present, no known conflicts.
Larry Baldwin.
Present, no known conflicts.
D.R. Bryan.
Present, no conflicts.
Bob Emery.
Present, no conflicts.
Robert High. Sheila Holman.
Present, no known conflicts.
Doug Medlin. Phil Norris.
Present,
Lauren Salder. Earl Smith.
Present, no known conflicts.
Dick Tunnell. Angie Wills.
Present, no known conflict.
That's 10.
Thank you, Angela. Before we get started, this is, first of all, on behalf of the commission, our thanks to Mayor Ben Smith, Administrator Daisy Ivey, for the use of their facilities both yesterday and today. I don't know about y'all, but this is a wonderful facility. Daisy, a lot of towns will be very interested in the facilities that you have. Further thanks to Daisy and Justin for arranging transportation to go see the new groin, and having your engineering representatives to explain the groin, the design processes, and answer questions. It was really very educational and enlightening to see that process. Y'all are the model to hold up for other communities as they go forward.
Well, thank you.
And Daisy, do you have anything you'd like to say this
Just welcome on behalf of the Ocean Isle Beach, and just a few housekeeping. If you need the restrooms, they're out this door to the left and maybe to your right, and right next door is some water and coffee if you'd like some, but we're happy that you are all here and hope you'll come back soon.
Well, now that we've spent about 4 years since we've been here, and we're in a little meeting space, Brother Al came a little bit, we'll be back.
Thank you.
It's our commitment to try to see all areas of the coast and what's more fitting to be down in this area at this time of year. So thank you ever so much.
You're welcome.
And also, just one more thing to Cam's staff, our deepest sympathy on the loss of Charlotte. We really do. Charlotte was a long-time employee in the planning area. And I've got to tell you, when I first joined the town, I won't tell you how many years ago that was, Cam. Charlotte was one of the first employees that I met and dealt with on every single land use item that the town of Axe had ever submitted. So thank you. Next up, would all of you have a handout at your desk. That would be taken care of under new business later in the meeting for information and so forth.
the motion will be needed to approve the minutes of the November 17th, 2022 meeting.
Larry Baldwin, please.
Mr. Baldwin, second by Commissioner Morris. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor? All opposed? Here's to unanimous. Thank you, Angela. Practice, the floor is yours.
Good morning, Chair, members of the Commission. Renee, I appreciate the comment. I wanted to start out my comments in the same way. Charlene was our district planner in Elizabeth City for almost 19 years, and it was very sad for us. She passed away in late December, and we continue to honor her memory as our friend and valued colleague for everything she contributed to our program throughout the years of her service, and miss her both personally and professionally, and our thoughts and best wishes for me and with her family and friends. So thank you for that. So with that, I will begin my updates on DCM's activities since your last meeting. On the regulatory side, our new e-permitting system is in full swing for major permits. We are now processing those electronically. DCM was the first agency within the Department of Environmental Quality to implement the new e-permitting system. Greg Bodner has done a really fantastic job working with our staff, with local governments, state, federal agencies that are part of our review process in leading that initiative, and it really will improve as we work out the kinks with any new system. You know, long term, it really should improve the application process for applicants. It's far more efficient, and it'll also improve the accessibility of our historical permitting records. So we're very excited to have that up and running. And as you'll hear from Greg later in this agenda today, we anticipate beginning the testing phase for CAMA general permits soon. Also, since your last meeting, North Carolina Department of Transportation completed the removal of Highway 12 and the sandbag structures just north of Merlot Beach. That was a major undertaking, required constant coordination between DOT and DCM due to the sheer volume of bags that have been placed there over the years. It was 1,400 bags, I believe, that have been removed, and we are continuing to coordinate with them as more bags have been uncovered. Another DOT project you may recall us mentioning in the past, I saw it on the way down here yesterday. The construction has begun of the Highway 24 Living Shoreline project in Swansboro that was carried out in partnership with the Coastal Federation. That contractor is making substantial progress at the site, and structure should be completed in the next few weeks with the backfill and oyster structure shortly thereafter. So if you're driving up that way, check it out along the causeway there in Swansboro. Very, very neat to see that progressing. In December, we held a workshop for the Central and Southern District's local permitting officers at UNCW. The workshop included formal presentations by staff, and we had regulatory staff there from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Wilmington District. We had some hands-on training out in the field with the LPOs. It was a good crowd, really good dialogue and discussions about how rules are applied and procedures. Staff would like to thank UNCW for their partnership as well with helping to facilitate that workshop. I wanted to provide an update this morning on offshore wind energy as well. As you may know, North Carolina has four potential offshore wind farms at this time. Kitty Hawk North and Kitty Hawk South are both owned. The leases are owned by Avangrid Renewables. And Carolina Long Bay, which was also known as the Wilmington East Wind Energy Area, has two leases. One owned by Duke Energy and one Total, I believe is the way you pronounce it, Total Energies. Kitty Hawk North is about 24 nautical miles offshore. The cable routes for that project have not yet been officially determined. I think there are discussions still ongoing about that project landing in Virginia. We do have a federal consistency determination that's been submitted to our division, which serves as the state's review agency for offshore wind. And so we received a federal consistency determination for Kitty Hawk North. This is at the construction operation, the final phase that we see as part of the process. The review deadline for their construction operations plan is was April of this year. However, we have entered into a stay agreement with the company until they get their draft environmental assessment work done through the NEPA process. And so that's going to be on hold for quite a while as they work through the NEPA process, so that the state has all of that information as part of the NEPA process as part of its review. Kitty Hawk South is about 27 miles offshore. Its cable route also not yet confirmed. DCM has received a federal consistency determination as well for the construction operations plan for Kitty Hawk South. The developer and DCM have also entered into a stay agreement until the draft EA is published on that one. The current deadline for that one right now is not until July of 2025. For Carolina Long Bay, DCM received a federal consistency determination from BOEM. This is an earlier phase, and this is at the lease auction and site assessment plan phase of offshore wind development. We did find that initial lease auction and site assessment plan consistent with our program, with our state's coastal policies, and but we did condition it on a pre-coordination meeting with Marine Fisheries and our office to look at exactly what they'll be doing as part of their site assessment plan work. And that hasn't happened yet. That lease area is about 20 nautical miles offshore. There will eventually be federal consistency determinations on that as well for the construction operations plan. There was also a recent phone call for additional wind energy area identification offshore North Carolina in the Central Atlantic region. The initial focus is on an area that's a little farther offshore and a little to the north of the Kitty Hawk wind energy area. BOEM conducted a public comment period as part of that, and my understanding is that they're still reviewing the public comments and other aspects of identifying those wind energy areas. On the policy and planning side of our program, we recently announced the availability of approximately $3 million in funding to help local governments improve public access to beaches and waters for the 2023-24 fiscal year. The pre-application period is now open. Local governments interested in applying for financial assistance need to submit their pre-applications to us by April 28th. Additional information is on our website, or let us know, and we will help you out with that. At the November meeting, I informed you that additional DCM funding through our planning and management grants program was available for local governments, and we were prioritizing support for the development of local beach management plans, as well as any plans or ordinances focused on shoreline management or water use planning. The division has now awarded 6 grants associated with local beach planning to the town of Surf City, Carteret County, Dare County, town of Nagshead, town of Oak Island, and town of Brightsville Beach. So please let me know if you're interested in more information about those projects. It's been a busy time for our Resilient Coastal Communities program. DCM received applications from 15 communities for phases 1 and 2 grants under the RCCP, as well as applications from several organizations who will be providing technical assistance to the communities. Phases 1 and 2 include the asset mapping, vulnerability assessments, community engagement, and project identification and prioritization. Phase 3 is engineering design, and phase 4 will be actual construction implementation projects. We will award approximately $1 million in grants in the coming weeks. We hope to have the work begin by May 1st. At the same time, 20 communities are close to completing engineering and design work that the program funded last fall. We're also preparing to release a request for proposals for phase 4 construction grants, and we expect to be able to fund several of those projects, including featuring natural and nature-based techniques. Finally, we'll be preparing an application to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation over the next couple of months with the hope of bringing in additional federal revenues and resources to support our local government resilience planning efforts. For more information on that, we have a number of resilient staff and tech right here as well to help fill you in on those activities. I wanted to let you know that the Commission Science Panel on Coastal Hazards will be meeting virtually on Wednesday, the 1st, March 1st, that is, to continue their work on updating the sea level rise work that they're doing. Those are all public meetings. This one is virtual. So I think there was a press release that went out on this a while back. We will send out reminders to the Commission and CRAC. And if anybody else, we encourage folks to join in. And so let us know if you need information on that one. In our Coastal Reserve Program, we're working with a range of partners on some recently awarded externally funded projects. For example, the Reserve is working with APNEP, the Nature Conservancy, and North Carolina Sea Grant to develop an engagement strategy to support the Scuppernong Regional Water Management Study with funding from the NOAA Digital Coast Partnership. We're also partnering with other southeastern National Stream Research Reserves to examine or to evaluate basically drones as a tool for mapping intertidal oyster reef characteristics and changes over time. And the Reserve is working closely with NC State on a NEARS science collaborative study, funded study, to better understand the interaction between storm events, river systems, and coastal processes, and how they interact and impact sediment dynamics over time, and therefore the vulnerability of different coastal habitats. The Reserve and North Carolina Sea Grant are accepting applications for our 2023 North Carolina Coastal Research Fellowship. That program supports graduate students in North Carolina looking at research within one or more of our 10 coastal reserve sites. And the deadline for applications is March 17th. More information on our website. And finally, the Coastal Training Program will be delivering some additional workshops on living shorelines and low-impact development to realtors this April in partnership with the Cape Fear Realtors Association and Brunswick County Association of Realtors. Please let us know if you're interested in those workshops. We'll let you know how to attend and give you the information on those. And I will end with just some more staffing news. We always end up having staff turnover lately. It's an ongoing thing. So we have recently filled a number of positions in our Morehead City District office. We now have two new field representatives. Kara Guthrie started in January after serving as a temporary employee with the division for the past year. Richard Mahoney will be starting early next month and comes to us from the UNC Institute of Marine Sciences. And in the Elizabeth City office, we have recently hired Martin Mitchell, who recently retired from the Virginia Department of Transportation. Those new hires will leave us with one remaining field representative opening in our Washington office. Shane Staples, many of you may know Shane, is accepted a position with the Army Corps of Engineers. We've lost him to that position, but wish him well, and we will be filling that position soon. In the Coastal Reserve Program, you may recall Brandon Puckett moved on to a job with NOAA, our research coordinator, and Dr. Justin Ridge will now be joining us as a new research coordinator next week. Justin comes to us from the Duke University Marine Lab, where he led the Marine Robotics and Remote Sensing Labs Coastal Mapping Research Program. He's got a master's degree in biological oceanography from FIT, and a PhD in marine science from UNC. He focuses research on North Carolina sounds, oyster reefs, and erosion. Also, Jillian Daly joined the Reserve as the new communications specialist this week. She's a recent graduate of UNC Chapel Hill with a BS in environmental science and a minor in marine science. So we're very happy to welcome all these new folks aboard. It's a really good crowd, and we're very happy with all the folks that have been joining our program lately. Good new staff. So excited to have them. The Reserve is also in the process of hiring some interns and seasonal positions in our Beaufort and Wilmington offices. The undergraduate students will be working with us this summer thanks to support from the Friends of the Reserve and the North Carolina Internship Program and NOAA's Education Partnership Program with minority-serving institutions. So those students will be working with us on stewardship and education projects, including Spanish translation of some of our outreach materials and education materials. More information about the internships and seasonal positions is available on the Reserve website. Thank you for the time, and with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the commission.
Thank you, Dr. Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Seeing none. Bob, it's almost time for you. Before you get started, I'd like to welcome a longtime member of the CRNC, Darren Moore from Oak Island. Darren, you sure you don't want to come back? Bobby's here if you want to talk to
him. It's good to see everybody again, but this is just a one-time visit.
Good morning, Bob. You had quite a crowd yesterday.
Good morning. Yes, we did. We had a pretty robust CRAC meeting for a change yesterday. Not often we go and have a CRAC meeting with standing room only, so it was a good meeting. The thrust of the meeting and most of the time spent in the meeting was dealing with the septic tank rules that you all are going to look at later today on your agenda. And there was a lot of questions and a lot of explanations from staff there were really only, from that, only two issues that rose to the level that need some attention, at least from the CRAC perspective. We received comments from our communities. I think Braxton had received comments from up and down the coast. And so with those things said, there are two issues. One's with 7H306F, and in 306F there's a private-public funding differential. So my house is on the beach and I want to do something under the rules and I pay for it out of my pocket, then I can do it. Whereas if I'm getting any federal money and I'm next door, I can't do the same thing that my neighbor is doing. And from our perspective, that created an unfairness among property owners, our goal being to get septic tanks and drain fields and all those sorts of things off of the beach area, but wasn't to create, you know, those kind of things. That wasn't an intentional act with regard to this. That's a remnant of an older policy that you all have about using federal monies and what the policy is for using those things. Don't argue with that. Just argue with that with respect to what we're trying to do with septic tanks. And so we'd ask that you all take a look at that and let's make sure that we're feeding all the oceanfront property owners out of the same spoon and that we treat people fairly there. The second thing is another kind of remnant of an old rule. In 306G, you have it's really part of your sandbag rules. You have an 8-year time frame to remove structures. And since we're now defining septic tanks as structures, it's creating an anomaly, I guess, in the rule. Does that mean that if I have my septic tanks there to spale, I can leave it there 8 years as I could with the sandbag structure? And that isn't what we intended or think that we intended either. And so just need to tighten that up to make it clear that, you know, when they fail and when you can't get a permit again, then they need to go. They don't need to sit there for 8 years under that rule. There was a lot of discussion about how that applied. There was not a lot of clarity because it triggers all kinds of other rules. But really what the CRC asks is that staff take a look at that and make sure we aren't doing something unintentionally because we've got an older rule there that doesn't fit well with this. And so those were the two main issues that came out of the discussion on that. And as you work through those rules, then take a look at those two provisions and see what we can do there. We had a little bit of public comment yesterday. I know one of the people that spoke is going to speak to you in a minute, so I won't elaborate on that. But the crux of that was more notice, more letting the people know what we're doing, what was going on. That they'll speak for themselves in a little while, but that came up too. In our new business, you know, John Farrell, one of our CRAC members from Sunset Beach, has been working hard on resiliency plans down at Sunset Beach, and he presented some information about some mapping, some GIS stuff that was very interesting and enlightening to those of us that were there, and certainly gave us some food for thought about how to do our own resiliency plans. Some of the things he's suggesting, Braxton and his team were already working on, a lot of that stuff is available, but it was an interesting kind of a nod and a push to the local communities to start looking at those things and looking at those tools, and a little bit of a push to the DCM to start making more of those tools available, and they're already doing that and working on that. So it was a very good and interesting conversation. We had another issue come up with regard to the Real Estate Commission. The Real Estate Commission is now doing some disclosure rules, and I know, from my understanding from that conversation, you all had looked at some disclosure rules some years ago, but they never went anywhere. It's another opportunity to look at those for sale of real estate and oceanfront disclosures for a lot of things. I mean, in Dare County, for us, we've got the problems that you all know about down in Rodanthe. That's sort of the poster child for the need for some little better disclosure rules at the contracting stage, not at the closing stage for people that are contemplating purchasing oceanfront property. And so bring that to your attention so that as those rules go through, that maybe you all as DCM get involved to be sure at least the concerns that you have get addressed or at least discussed in that process. At the end of the meeting, Spencer, Jeremy talked to you a minute ago about our trip down to the inlet, and it was interesting. Spencer took us through sort of a history and a time lapse. If you haven't seen that time lapse, you ought to get the PowerPoint, look at it. It's fascinating to see how the inlet moved and the things that it did. And when you see that and then go look at what's there now and what it's done there now, it really is interesting how they did it and what it's doing. And nobody's claimed success yet because it's not been there long enough, but so far so good. And so maybe it's a good thing, and we'll see in the long term. So a very good meeting and some very good information from us. The last thing I have on my list is not something that came up in our CRAC agenda, but I do need to share with you that Braxton talked to me about this morning. I also serve on the NC Byway, and one of the things that they're pushing for, we're pushing for, is to update the BIMP. The BIMP is about 5 years old now. It's not supposed to be renewed for another 5 years. And with all the changes and costs, all the things that are going on the coast, all the things that are happening, it's hard to know how anyone you are, the legislature, or whoever, that are going to be looking at coastal issues and funding and all those kind of things can really do it without an updated plan that's current to now. So we'd ask you for your support to encourage whoever's doing the BIMP and whoever's funding that to move that forward, and let's get a current plan out there that we and everyone else can plan on and do the things that we need to do along the coast. With that said, are there any questions for the CRAC?
Any questions? Please.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Bobby. I just wanted to let everyone know that the division department does support the renewal of the BIMP, and there is some proposed legislative language that I saw briefly from NC Byway, so I can't speak to that specific language yet, but I can tell you that, you know, from our perspective, the update of the BIMP is very much in line with what we like to see with local beach planning, where you're looking ahead and trying to figure out where your sediment sources are, where your finances, how much you'll need, and look at sediment budgets and things to determine what's changing on the coast, as Bobby just said. So from our perspective, that's a very worthwhile endeavor.
Did y'all define the
BIMP? Oh, sorry. Ken can probably remind me, the first BIMP was the Beach and Inlet Management Plan. It's the state's Beach and Inlet Management Plan. I think the first one was in the 2000s. And then there was an update in 2015. That was done by both were done by Moffitt and Nichol, I believe. So that would be a contract out, most likely, is the way it would be done.
Contracted out through the division?
That's what's currently being discussed in terms of, well, it's a request to the legislature to fund the update, and then there's some discussion going on. In the past, it was done through the Division of Water Resources, but we're looking at where that best should land.
Well, I'm going to ask a question while we're on the floor right now. Would the commission be amenable to writing a letter endorsing an updated BIMP sooner rather than later?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right, you and Mary draw something up. We'll send it forward. Thank you, Washoe.
Going back to one of the updates from the crowd yesterday, and that is the Real Estate Commission rulemaking. As I understand that, petition for rulemaking, and there is a draft rule available, so I just ask that the petition and the draft rule be shared with the CRC members.
That, let's hope that moves forward. That's something very important. As the chair of track said, it doesn't need to be disclosed at closing, it needs to be disclosed that people are looking at buying property. All relevant information needs to be shared sooner rather than later.
Bobby, I'd just like to say, for other people in the audience, crack, they don't do illegal things. They are very important to the CRC as policy. Issues are being discussed. Yesterday's meeting was definitely one of the best attended crack meetings I've been to, but the biggest thing are the different issues. Very technical issues, but there was great dialogue. I thought it was a very good meeting, and then to top it off with the groin, it was very educational.
we're there to help you, but you have to allow us to do that. And so as you come to issues, send them down. We have a wide range of views. We have it's a big committee. It represents the entire coast. It represents lots of interests on the coast. And so it's easy to get good conversation if you all send it down. And as I've said before, I'll tell them, as we have issues in our local communities, it can start from the bottom up, too. We can bring things just John Farrell did yesterday with the resiliency stuff. We can bring it up from the bottom and bring it to you all, too. And as long as we're both doing that, then we'll have those good, robust meetings. And I think that's good for policy and helps you all make good decisions. So thank you. And please continue to let us know how we can help you.
Thanks, Spencer. His presentation yesterday on that timeline from 1938 forward was extremely interesting. But he also handed out a lot of I hadn't had one for a long time. And I know we gave a lot of them out yesterday, but if anybody wants one, they should contact Spencer and see if they can get some more in print.
It's a limited supply, so if you have one, you may have a relic. Sorry.
Okay. Any questions for the chair?
Are all, and I apologize, I shouldn't have this, but are all of the presentation materials from the CRAC posted on our website after the meetings?
I believe that they are.
We can make that happen.
So we can go back and reference Spencer's presentation.
Yeah. He's a wealth of knowledge.
All right.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Next up is the variance, Town of Carolina Beach, oceanfront setback. Good morning, Mr. Beverly.
Facing west from the Carolina Beach boardwalk.
on the Carolina Beach Boardwalk. This is a view of the existing public bathrooms facing south from the Carolina Beach Boardwalk. And this was the drawing submitted with the minor permit application showing the footprint of the proposed bathroom. And here are your variance criteria for the variance. Thank you.
The Carolina Beach Building Line Act was passed in 1963. That session law granted the town title to the land between the building line and the low water mark of the Atlantic Ocean, subject to public trust rights. That session law also provides that no building or structure shall be built and erected on the main and built-up land lying east of the building line, and further provides that all made and constructed land lying east of the building line shall be at all times kept open for the purpose of street and highways for the use of the public and further for the development of uses of a public square or park. Though the commission's development line rules have now been repealed, the town had adopted a development line in September of 2016, the location of which is depicted on the development line map included in your materials. It's located in the same location as that 1963 building line. On the stipulated exhibit that we just saw, it's also the blue line overlaid on the aerial imagery prepared by the town with their application. Prior to the adoption of the town's development line, in accordance with your rules, the town had a static line exception approval from the commission, first in August of 2009, and it was last renewed by the commission in February of 2020. Following the repeal of the commission's development line rules, the static line exception remains in effect in Carolina Beach. The site, as we saw, is within the ocean erodible area of environmental concern. The site is currently developed with an existing one-story brick and cinder block bathroom building. The building is not accessible directly from the boardwalk. A wheelchair or similar device must leave the wooden boardwalk and access the bathhouse from the alley. A route is shown on aerial photography that are included in your stipulated exhibits. The existing structure does not have any ADA-compliant bathroom stalls. On September 7th of last year, the town applied for a Camel Minor development permit, requesting approval of construction of a two-story, 36-by-28 bathroom facility, which would replace the existing facility. The second floor of the proposed bathroom facility will connect directly to the boardwalk and will include three handicapped accessible stalls. The ground floor portion of it will also include three handicapped accessible stalls. The town stipulates that the proposed bathroom facility is located in a VE coastal high hazard flood zone and does not meet the requirements for construction as designed. However, the town will be seeking a variance from the town's Board of Adjustment. The town contends that as a condition precedent to seeking that local variance, the town must first receive a variance from the CRC and a subsequent CAMA permit. So accordingly, the town is also seeking a procedural variance from the commission's rule at 0701, which requires a variance petitioner to first seek relief from local requirements restricting use of the property. In part of the permitting, DCM posted a notice placard on the site on September 28th. DCM also ran notice of the proposed project in the Wilmington Star News on October 2nd, and was also on their online paper version. On September 28th, the town issued a press release on their website regarding the application, and on the September 29th, the town put notice on their Facebook page. As part of the Camel Minor permit process, notice of the project was required to be given to adjacent riparian landowners. DCM did not receive any comments from them. We did receive comments from two folks, one who indicated support for the project and one who asked some questions regarding the ventilation of the project. On October 4th, the Division of Coastal Management denied the town's application because the development extended ocean work of the landward most adjacent habitable building or structure as described in the static line exception rules at 7H0306A9C. And then also a bathhouse is not among the setback exception structures that are listed in 0309A. The town previously did petition the commission for and received three variances for development more seaward than the vegetation line or pre-project line. That included a variance in 2014 for the central and southern part of the boardwalk, one in 2015 for the northern end of the existing boardwalk, and then in 2021 for the beach mats. So the town at this time is requesting a variance from the commission's setback rules at 0306A9C in order to develop the bathhouse as proposed in its Hammond Minor permit application. We agree on all four of the variance requirements in this case, so I'll just run through those. On the first, whether strict application of the rules creates an unnecessary hardship. The proposed location of the expanded bathhouse is on the uniquely town-owned public beach within the Central Business District. The proposed structure largely meets the oceanfront setback, except a portion of the structure, approximately 130 square feet in area, that is waterward of the pre-project veg line. The expanded bathhouse will have more total stalls by having two floors and will enhance public access along the beach and the boardwalk by replacing the existing facilities. Additionally, it will have at least three ADA-compliant stalls on each floor and access directly from the boardwalk, rather than requiring those with disabilities to have to exit and enter through the ramp or through the alley. On the second factor, the hardships are caused by a combination of the town's unique ownership of the historically maintained dry sand beach, identified by the General Assembly for public access purposes, and the provision of enhanced handicap access to this unique feature. Additionally, the bathhouse will be at the same location as the existing bathhouse and is convenient to the boardwalk, the beach mats, and on the town's owned area. The third factor, do hardships result from actions taken by petitioner? Staff says no. Petitioner proposes to build a replacement structure in the same site as the existing bathhouse and has little ability to site a larger structure landward out of the pre-project vegetation line. Staff contend that this minor incursion into the setback will enhance access for the public. Finally, on the fourth factor, staff agrees that granting the requested variance would be consistent with the spirit, purpose, and intent of the commission's rules. The limited area of the proposed bathhouse enlargement in the same location as the existing house results in a de minimis portion, approximately 130 square feet of area, of the proposed structure being waterward of the pre-project line. However, it increases access for visitors with disabilities specifically and for the public generally, which would meet the legislative goals of the CAMA. Though this proposed use and location are not within the listed development exceptions in 0309 within the setback area, it's consistent with the Commission's general policy of allowing only small-scale development within the setback area. So I'll invite Noel Fox to come up and talk about the town's position on the court measures and take any questions after that.
Good morning. I guess I'm going to be somewhere in the middle of the night. I'm Noel Fox. I'm the town attorney at North Carolina Beach, and it's my pleasure to appear before you here today for the, I think, the third or fourth variance related to this boardwalk, which has become highly accessible to those with disabilities. The town has undertaken a concerted effort over, with your assistance, over the last 8 or 9 years to improve accessibility to the public beach with this boardwalk. This bathroom facility is currently not ADA accessible. The proposed structure will include three ADA accessible stalls on each floor. The 130 feet that is at issue here is so that it can connect to the set that where the boardwalk, if the wooden boardwalk exists. This is it's an unnecessary hardship now for those that are traveling from the beach mats to have to traverse all the way from the beach through the boardwalk, down the boardwalk ramp to the concrete boardwalk to get to the first floor, and then they experience their own struggles regarding the stalls and there not being ADA compliant. So I agree with staff's position. It was the town's position as well to meet the four criteria. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, understanding that this is the first step for the town and the town's ordinance, and we will have to go before the town's board of adjustment for the flood regulations.
Thank you. Any questions for the Christian or no at this time? Seeing none, does anyone have a motion about criteria one, the strict application of the applicable development rule standards orders issued by the commission to cause the petitioner unnecessary hardships? If so, the petitioner must identify the hardships. And both the petitioner and staff position was yes. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair, and I would move that we approve both staff and petitioner.
Motion by Commissioner Norris. Is there a second? Second by Commissioner Holman. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor? All opposed? Unanimous, I put in.
Yes, ma'am.
Next, criteria two. Such hardships result in conditions peculiar to the petitioner's property, such as location, size, and topography of the property. And staff and petitioner both answer is yes. Is there a motion on criteria two?
Chair, I'll make the motion we accept both the petitioner and staff position.
Commissioner Andrew, is there a second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Wills and Commissioner Andrew. Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? Unanimous. Criteria three, the hardships result from actions taken by the petitioner. The petitioner and staff position is no. Is there a motion on criteria three?
I'll also make the motion that we accept petitioner and staff position on criteria three.
Thank you, Commissioner Andrews. Seconded by Commissioner Norris. Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? Next, criteria four. Will the variance requested by the petitioner be consistent with the spirit, purpose, and intent of the rules, standards, or orders issued by the commission? Two, secure the public safety and welfare. And three, preserve substantial justice. Petitioner staff both say yes. Is there a motion on criteria four? Motion by Commissioner Smith. Is there a second? Second by Commissioner Fulton. Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? It's unanimous. Do we need a take any further motion to waive our rules about them having to go before the town? We need a motion that pushing the town from the criteria that they must receive a variance from the town, or they can come to us first.
So moved.
First, Norris and Holman.
I'll second.
Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? So moved. Congratulations, you got my vote. No, you're batting 100. I don't know how many more you can come and get 100. No more. Next up, Town of Ocean Beach, straw hay bales, S.M.
They were
Mike Levin
on there.
Okay. Is this your seat?
from where is it then?
It's probably UT Drive.
We're going to take a 5-minute break while they get the technology straight
over on you there.
Oh no, you're good.
Thank you. post-construction of the drawing. Proposed project locations are denoted with red stars from left to right. In each axis is Lumpkin Street, Durham Street, Charlotte Street, Chalo Boulevard, Columbia Street, and East and East Third Street. This photo is looking west towards from the east end. Looking back, you can see pre- and post-construction photos. There's another shot looking northeast showing pre- and post-construction of the drawing. Here's a shot looking east towards the Shiloh Inlet, pre- and post-construction of the drawing. These photos are taken at Shiloh Boulevard, looking east, which shows some pre- and post-construction photos of the drawing re-nourishment. Here's a photo looking west, looking back at the east end of East 3rd Street. Here's a photo looking east towards Shiloh, Shiloh Inlet. This is taken post-construction. Provided by Figure 8 Island through DCM. This photo shows some hay bales that were installed on Figure 8 Island using the sand fencing guidelines. These photos were also provided by Figure 8 Island 2015 hay bales installed using sand fencing guidelines. These photos were taken in front of 474 East 3rd Street, looking west towards 470 East 3rd during Hurricane Ian. These photos were provided by the petitioner. These photos were taken in the backyard of 455 East 3rd Street, looking north towards the homes on East 4th during Hurricane Ian. This photo was taken at 469 East 3rd Street, looking east towards the Shiloh Inlet during Hurricane Ian. Photo Shiloh Boulevard looking east down East 3rd Street during Hurricane Ian. This image is courtesy of Ocean Isle Beach pre-drawing construction showing the proposed location of the pine straw bales on Lumberton Street. This photo is courtesy of DCM taken in January 2023 post-drawing construction at the Lumberton Beach access. Showing the location of those pine straw bales. For reference, it's approximately 130 feet from the toe of the burns to the current high water line. This photo is courtesy of the petitioner, taken in 2021 pre-drawing construction, showing the placement of proposed pine straw bales at the end of Durham Street Beach Access. These are current site conditions provided by DCM 2023 showing the approximate toe of the berm, which would be landward of the existing gazebo and beach access way. It's approximately 179 feet from the toe of the existing berm to the high water line. This photo is courtesy of the petitioner pre-drawing construction from 2021 showing the proposed location of the pine straw bales at the south end of the Charlotte Street beach access. The current location, current site conditions provided by DCM showing the approximate toe of the berm, which is approximately 112 feet to the high water line at the Charlotte Street Beach access. This photo is courtesy of the petitioner showing pre-drawing construction conditions on the south end of Shiloh Boulevard, showing the proposed location of the hay bales. First three sites we showed were proposed location of straw bales and pine straw bales, and the next three would be placement of hay bales. Current conditions at the end of Shiloh Boulevard beach access for the proposed hay bales is approximately 212 feet from the total berm to the high water line. This photo is courtesy of the petitioner pre-drawing construction showing the location of the proposed hay bales. The south end of Columbia Street, as well as the location of proposed hay bales at the far end of East 3rd Street. current site conditions provided by DCM at the end of South End of Columbia Street, the beach access showing the approximate toe of the berm, approximately 233 feet from the toe of the berm to the high water line. And this is a shot from DCM in January of 2023 showing the east end of East 3rd Street, the approximate toe of the berm being 300 feet from the high water line. This graphic is provided by DCM showing the current sand fencing guidelines for placement of sand fences on the oceanward side of the existing dune or escarpment, whichever is furthest waterward. That's another graphic provided by DCM showing the proper location for the installation of sand fencing. And your variance criteria. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning again. In this case, the petitioner is the town of Ocean Isle Beach, represented by Ryan Eves. And after I've run through the statement of facts and the staff's positions, I'll run through the town's positions, and then we'll be happy to answer questions. The town owns the street ends, which generally run perpendicular to the ocean and dead end at the beach. In this variance, the six street end sites at issue moving east to west are east end of 3rd Street, Columbia Street, Shiloh Boulevard, Charlotte Street, Durham Street, and Lumberton Street, with the exception of the area along East 3rd public access is provided at each street end. The minimum opening for public access to these sites would be 8 feet, and so the total linear footage of area covered would be 472 feet. The town's six sites are located within the ocean hazard APC, while the current or old inlet hazard area ends at the approximate location of the groin. The pending new inlet hazard area would extend west past the westernmost site at Lumberton Street and encompass all six sites. The commission's average annual erosion rates used for determining erosion setbacks at the site, moving west to east again, are 2 feet per year for Lumberton Street, 4 feet per year for Durham and Charlotte Street, and 5 feet per year for Shiloh Boulevard, East 3rd, and Columbia. For several decades, the town has contended with chronic erosion along the easternmost portion of the town's oceanfront shoreline. In 2001, the Army Corps first nourished the beach through the town's CSRM project. However, due to the chronic erosion along the east end, the Corps project determined that placing material east of Shiloh Boulevard would not be included in that project, so no material was placed east of Shiloh Boulevard as part of that core project. In response, the town and many private property owners along the stretch installed sandbag revetments approximately 1,400 feet long, beginning at a point just west of Shiloh Boulevard and extending east to 469 East 3rd. Most of the sandbags were initially installed around 2005 and have been periodically repaired and replaced. Due to continued erosion, the sandbag revetment was extended 400 feet to the west just past Charlotte Street in 2012. Per the CAMA statute at 115A, 115.1, and your rules at 0308A, these sandbag revetments are not authorized to provide permanent shoreline protection solution for the impacted area. So based on that, the town moved forward with the proposal for a terminal groin. As we know, the terminal groin project was completed in April of last year. Following the construction of the terminal groin and associated beach fill project, the town covered many of the sandbags within the project area with stockpiled sand to create server dunes to provide additional protection. The town also planted dune vegetation atop these starter dunes to help increase their stability as the roots begin to grow over time to trap aliens transported sand, thereby functioning to build the dune in size over time. The town's consultant, Mr. Rossoff, contends that to date these starter dunes do not provide adequate protection from storm events. The commission's rules at 0308A2J allow sandbags to remain on the site if they remain covered by sand. Any portion of the temporary erosion control structure that becomes exposed above grade after the expiration of the permitted time shall be removed by the property owner within 30 days of notification from DCM. On November of 2021, the CRC met in Atlantic Beach. According to the meeting minutes, Director Braxton Davis reported that, quote, last weekend, a low coastal low pressure system combined with king tides caused impacts due to flooding and ocean overwash in numerous areas. And we are aware that some sandbags were overwashed in Ocean Isle. Later in that meeting, during the CRAC report to the CRC, at the time, Chair Rudy Rudolph reported that the CRAC also discussed the possibility of using hay bales in lieu of sand fencing. Figure 8 Island property owners have been trying this approach and reports that it's working well. CRC Chair Cocoon then directed staff to look at rule amendments that would allow the use of hay bales. Talking a little bit about the project at Figure 8 Island, they were initially placed on two lots for a total approximate shoreline length of 200 feet in May of 2015 without a CAMA permit authorization. DCM staff, along with staff from the Wildlife Resources Commission, met with Figure 8 Island HOA members at these lots to observe the unauthorized hay bales. In an effort to bring the unpermitted development into compliance, the HOA agreed to remove the unauthorized hay bales and then submitted a CAMA minor permit application in August of 2015. Prior to the issuance of that permit, DCM sought agency comments from both WRC and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. U.S. Fish and Wildlife responded that they don't have much more concerns for these structures than for sand fencing. WRC responded in part. They believed that the use of hay bales as sand fencing could have merit, that it appears from an early endeavor that the bales will do reasonably well catching the sand, and that it would be nice to only allow the bale installation on an experimental basis. WRC suggested that if allowed, the hay bales should be monitored by way of picture documentation on a monthly, seasonal, and storm event basis, and stated a concern regarding bale decomposition. On August 31st, DCM issued a CAMA minor development permit to Figure 8 HOA authorizing the use of hay bales as sand fencing on Figure 8 Island. The hay bales installed on Figure 8 were in place for no more than a few months due to storm activity, which washed them away. The memo referenced in the facts to come referenced stated that early site visits and photographs of the site indicated that hay bales did capture and hold sand within the first month of placement on the site. In response to the chair's direction, on January 28th of last year, DCM Assistant Native Permit Coordinator Kurt Weicker drafted a memo for the CRC regarding the possible use of hay bales as an alternative to sand fencing as part of the 7-day sand fencing exemption rule. The memo concluded with the following recommendation to the CRC. To date, no CAMA permit applications for the use of hay bales and sand fencing have been denied. At this time, DCM recommends maintaining the current minor permitting process for hay bales as opposed to the exemption until more information can be gathered from multiple sites across the state and further analyzed by resource agencies. Following those meetings, the town decided to pursue the installation of hay bales along various sections of the east end of the island. The town submitted a CAMA minor permit application that was dated April 6th. DCM proposed to utilize hay bales for the installation of sand fencing along the 6th Street End initiative. Although the town's original application requested the use of hay bales only, DCM staff requested that the town try both hay bales and pine straw bales so that DCM could compare the effectiveness of each type. As part of the CAMA minor permit process, the town sent notice to the adjacent riparian owners. DCM received no objections from any of the adjacent riparian owners. Through a June 14, 2022 email, the WRC expressed concerns about the town's proposed use of bales for sand fencing as, quote, they have undetermined impacts that should be vetted prior to allowance. In addition, the WRC stated, the direct, secondary, and cumulative impacts bales may have on these resources coastwide is unknown and should be discussed in more detail prior to the inclusion of bales as a management tool by DCM. Therefore, we request additional conversation occur between DCM, WRC, Fish and Wildlife to discuss impacts bales may have in the immediate area of installation, the cumulative impact they may have on repeat installations in the same area, the cumulative impact they may have on habitats with coastwide use, and the regulation it abuses is determined to be an appropriate tool. The discussion should occur prior to the issuance of any permits or allowances of bales on the ocean shorelines. Shortly, 2 days later, the Fish and Wildlife Service sent an email agreeing with WRC's comments. So on June 16th of last year, DCM denied the town's camera minor permit application as it was deemed inconsistent with your rule at 7H0311C. That rule states that sand fencing shall not be installed in a manner that impedes, traps, or otherwise endangers sea turtles, sea turtle nests, or sea turtle hatchlings. CAMA permit applications for sand fencing shall be subject to review by the WRC and the Fish and Wildlife Service in order to determine whether or not the proposed design or installation will have an adverse impact on sea turtles or other threatened or endangered species. Upon receipt of the CAMA permit denial letter, the town shared WRC and Fish and Wildlife's concerns with Coastal Protection Engineering Services of North Carolina, the town's consultant. Through a December 2nd, 2022 letter, CPE's senior biologist Brad Rossoff stated his opinion about the pros and cons of the use of hay bales and sand fencing, concluding that the benefits outweigh the potential for negative impacts caused by perceived risk. Of course, that's in your materials. On September 30th, on the east end of Ocean Isle Beach, it experienced overwash due to the effects of Hurricane Ian. That was shown in the pictures included in the PowerPoint. The town asserts that the desire to utilize bale fencing is a result of the unavailability of traditional sand fencing due to supply chain delays and material shortages coupled with labor shortages. As recently as January 10th of this year, the town's customary sand fence vendor, Green Resource, informed the town that sand fence manufacturers are experiencing more than normal backlogs due to raw material costs and labor shortages. After receiving the town's variance petition, DCM reached out to some contractors and towns to ask what their experience was obtaining sand fencing recently. The town of Wrightsville Beach indicated their last purchase of sand fencing was in May of last year, and that it was a slightly longer wait, and that there was a drastic price increase. Green Resource and Supply is also the town's supplier. DCM Elizabeth City District Manager Ron Rinaldi reached out to a beach push contractor up north who said that after a few weeks of no supply, chemical building materials recently got a truckload which sold out quickly and appears to have been used in the Frolic area. On January 3rd of this year, DCM Minor Permit Coordinator Rob Mayers disseminated an email to LPOs providing guidance to towns and property owners with respect to the use of Christmas trees and tree restoration, and when the 7K exemption was appropriate versus when a CAMA minor permit was needed. After receiving the town's variance petition, DCM sent a copy of that petition to both WRC and Fish and Wildlife and asked them to provide any comments on the petition to DCM. Through a January 27th letter, a copy of the materials, Fish and Wildlife stated its continuing concerns about the use of straw or hay bales to be used as sand fencing, specifically as it relates to sea turtles. Fish and Wildlife also stated concerns that a study project could incorrectly give oceanfront owners the impression they were approved statewide. WRC stated its continuing concerns about the use of straw and hay bales, most specifically regarding impacts to sea turtles. WRC also indicated that while there could be an opportunity for a study, it should involve significant consultation between Wildlife Resources, DCM, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife staff. DCM subsequently forwarded the WRC and Fish and Wildlife comments to the town on January 30th and 31st for their review. On January 30th, along with those comments, DCM provided contact information to the town for UNCW professor Dr. Zachary Long and Steve Mercer of Coastal Transplants, as they had expressed interest in DCM in working with the town on a potential monitoring program. Justin Whiteside, the town's assistant manager, contacted Mr. Mercer, but did not contact Dr. Long. In his communication with Mr. Mercer, Mr. Mercer replied, "I would like to respond in writing to your questions about sand fencing and supply chain issues over the past several years. My order wait time in 2019 was an average of 2 to 3 weeks for off-season sand fence. Since 2019, we have seen that wait time extend to 9 to 11 months due to the delays in receiving materials and the lack of labor. Earlier in January, it was a 4-month wait for fence, even in the off-season. In 2018, the price for a roll of fence was $35. In April of last year, it was $62. And a brush order in October, November was $81 a roll. The town has proposed a condition at Fact 42, which states, to minimize impacts to wildlife, the town proposes to remove any ties or ropes from the bales during installation. The town proposes to monitor the status of the bale sand fencing post-installation. This monitoring will consist of picture documentation on a monthly, seasonal, and post-storm basis. The town will likewise provide a statement regarding the status of bale decomposition. The aim of this monitoring will be to document bale effectiveness, material durability, in parentheses, intactness, and decomposition, and the bale fencing's effect on the surrounding habitat. If requested, the town agrees to erect signage at the project site that informs the public that the bale fencing project is a pilot study. The town proposed this monitoring after receiving the late January comments from Wildlife and Fishing, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. At the end of the stipulated fact summary, we agree with the town on the third factor, but not on the first, second, and fourth. So as to the first factor, will strict application of the applicable development rules, standards, or orders cause the petitioner unnecessary hardships? Staff say no. The town is seeking a variance from 0311C, which states that sand fencing shall not be installed in a manner that impedes, traps, or otherwise endangers sea turtles, sea turtle nests, or hatchlings. CMO permit applications for sand fencing should be subject to review by the WRC and Fish and Wildlife Service in order to determine whether or not the proposed design or installation will have an adverse impact on sea turtles or other threatened or endangered species. In this case, the DCM asked both the Wildlife Resources Commission and Fish and Wildlife to review the project, both during the application process as well as to review the variance petition. While the responses to the variance petition were more robust, both agencies have been consistent in raising concerns about the use of hay, straw, or pine as sand fencing. These concerns include the potential destruction of nesting habitat, potential for invasive species in the bales, and decomposition of the bales resulting in temperature impacts on sea turtle nests. They also raise concerns about possible cumulative impacts for the use of bales most wide in the state, especially given the lack of data regarding this proposed use. Fish and Wildlife did not recommend the approval of the proposed use by Ocean Isle as a pilot project due to the potential impacts and also the ease with which these structures may be installed and the resulting enforcement problems. WRC acknowledged there may be an opportunity to consider a research project on bales as a potential alternative to sand fencing, but they did not believe that the study is appropriate for this proposal and couldn't be adequately defined in the time frame of this variance hearing. Staff notes that characterizing the Figure 8 Island experience, which was over 8 years ago, as a success is an overstatement. That term may have been the term attributed to Mr. Rudolph in his crack report from the minutes. The unpermitted bales initially placed there were removed after approximately 6 weeks, and then the permitted bales remained only a matter of months before being washed away. While the photos show some collection of sand, staff note that they washed out in a storm in the fall of 2015. Beyond photos of the bales, not much was learned from their use, particularly regarding concerns about invasive species, temperature impacts, and interference with nesting habitat. The DCM does note that in your variance rules at 0703D, it allows that, quote, in the event that the commission cannot reach a final decision because it determines that more facts are necessary, it shall remand the variance matter to staff and the petitioner with an instruction for the parties to either agree on the necessary facts or to request a hearing in OAH to determine the facts. Staff also note that the commission, quote, may impose reasonable and appropriate conditions and safeguards upon any variance of grants. In this case, staff are recommending that any hardship in this case is necessary, where the WRC and Fish and Wildlife have stated concerns about the use of straw or pine straw bales as sand fencing as it relates to the possible negative impacts from on nesting sea turtles. Staff contends that any hardship is a result of both the supply chain issues for traditional wood sand fencing and the town's choice not to develop a scientific monitoring plan in collaboration with Wildlife and Fish and Wildlife prior to this variance hearing. While photographs may have been all that was requested by the agencies in 2015 for a much smaller project, recent comments on the proposal from these agencies have evolved and indicate that level of monitoring is insufficient for the agencies to evaluate the potential impacts and implications of the broader use of bales and sand fencing. So staff are recommending that the commission direct staff, petitioner, wildlife resources, and fish and wildlife to work together to develop and implement a monitoring or research plan that addresses procedural concerns. On the second factor, staff says that while the town has experienced chronic erosion over the years on the east end, they recently completed the terminal groin and fillet. Instead of removing the sandbags, they covered them with sand and planted portions of those covered bags to create starter dunes with the hope that the planted vegetation will collect more sand over time. Any hardship is due to the difficulty in obtaining traditional wood sand fencing and the lack of data regarding the use of hay bales and reasonable alternatives to traditional wooden sand fence. These are not hardships caused by conditions peculiar to the property as required by the statute and rule. It's not a size, location, or topography hardship. On the third factor, do the hardships result from the actions of the petitioner? Staff says no. While staff acknowledged that the town did not cause the hardships regarding the availability of traditional sand, wood sand fencing, staff did recommend pausing before proceeding with this variance in order to meet and collaborate with WRC, Fish and Wildlife, and potentially to work with Dr. Long at UNCW or Mr. Mercer of Coastal Transplants to develop a more robust monitoring plan in order to bring a detailed collaborative plan for consideration by the commission in the context of this variance. While the town has not done anything to accelerate erosion, staff contends that since the variance here is related to the potential turtle impact from bales and sand fence, the hardship would have to be related to that issue. Finally, on the fourth factor, the focus of the town's argument for this variance is on the need to use bales and sand fencing in order to protect the East End Road from further erosion, where they've constructed the starter dunes of the existing sandbag. And this is due to the supply chain issues from wooden fencing. The town further contends that they relied on staff and the commission's, quote, recommendation in the February 2022 about the possibility of using straw and pine straw bales. Staff notes that the use of the word recommendation is from staff's memo to the CRC in February of last year. It was not a recommendation for applicants to use alternatives to sand fencing materials, but was instead staff's recommendation of procedurally keeping alternative sand fencing materials reviewed through the CAMA minor permit process versus the exemption process until more information can be gathered from multiple sites across the state and further analyzed by resource agencies. The staff contend that granting a variance with only the town's proposal to provide monthly seasonal post-storm photographs and to report on decomposition is not within the spirit, purpose, and intent of 7H0311, which requires DCM to coordinate with wildlife resources and fish and wildlife to ensure that sand fencing will not have adverse impacts on sea turtles. Those agencies have expressed concerns in this case, both in reviewing the permit application and in reviewing the variance petition. Staff suggests granting a variance for the use of bales would be more in the spirit, purpose, and intent of the rule if the project included a monitoring program undertaken in such a way that it could be scientifically useful to the review agencies in managing or mitigating potential impacts from the use of bales. The discussions by the CRAC and Commission considering whether to initiate rulemaking or to continue reviewing alternative material sand fencing through the CAMA minor permit process was not intended to encourage study projects to move forward without consultation from WRC and Fish and Wildlife. While it may be helpful to undertake a pilot project to examine how bales perform longer term, it should be based on consultation with those agencies. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Eves, and then we'll be happy to take questions after that.
Yes, please.
Brian Eves, I'm honored to be here on behalf of the town of Ocean Isle. And I have a PowerPoint to figure that out.
Thank you.
Shows that no action was taken on the town's permit within the first 25 days. We are not here today to litigate that. I just want to reserve the town's right. We have to take that up at a lot of time. The town respectfully disagrees with staff on the first two criteria. I'll try not to be repetitive, but as Ms. Goble pointed out in the stipulated fact, the east end of Ocean Isle has a very unique history. We have suffered chronic erosion for several decades. After we found the stipulated fact number five, stipulated fact number six, it was so bad that the east end, the Corps, in conducting their cost-benefit analysis, determined that it wasn't worth the money to place the material east of Shiloh Boulevard. Stipulated facts 7 and 8, you will note, as a consequence of the Corps not placing material there, the town and the residents ultimately ended up with a 1,800-foot feet of sandbag to combat this erosion. Stipulated facts 9 and 10 show that in 2016, the town applied for and was granted a major permit to construct the groin. There was litigation over that, but ultimately the groin was completed in April of 2022. As Ms. Goble pointed out, we intended to have star dunes to protect the area flanking the groin, and I used to say fillet, but Mr. Whiteside educated me that it's called a fillet, but it's basically flat out there. Stipulated facts number 11, we did consult with CP&E. They were the coastal engineering firm that oversaw the growing project. And Brad Rosoff, their senior biologist, you will note the very last sentence there. The starter dunes do not provide adequate protection from storm events. Stipulated fact number 14, and I think this is pretty clear and unequivocal. The condition of the east end of the town remains vulnerable to storm events overwash given the lack of a dune system in that area, despite the fact that there's a groin there, the fillets there, and the existing sandbags have been covered. So I contend that it's, well, let's just look at these pictures again. It's a hardship, and it's a hardship unique to this town on the east end. There's only two groins in the state, and we're one of them. And our history of accelerated erosion, efforts with sandbag, core not placing sand, all of that is unique and peculiar to the east end of Ocean Island. Stipulated fact 14. East End remains vulnerable to storm event overwash given the lack of a dune system in that area. It seems to me from staff's position on the criteria that they are trying to wedge the town's argument into the hardship being a supply chain delay on traditional sand fencing. I submit to you a fair reading of our position on the criteria is that we are unprotected out there, and the supply chain problem exacerbates that hardship. But in the spirit of the rules, I think that is both relevant and should be considered given the nature of the hardship, a lack of protection. As Ms. Coble pointed out, the staff reached out to a few other areas of the state who were able to get sand pits in quicker than we can. So I would submit to you that the supply chain shortage as it relates to the town of Ocean Isle is likewise peculiar to the property because this is the geographic area where we're trying to get it. That picture there, which was also in staff's presentation, was after Hurricane Ian. You can see the mailbox there, depending on how tall you are. That's about belly button high. That's some pretty significant overwash. Another picture of Hurricane Ian. All this is on the east end of the subject area. You can see that's in the backyard that's half full of water. There's a picture of the overwash coming in during the hurricane. And this is looking east. It's kind of hard to see in that picture, but if you look towards the edges, you can see the pooling of the water and the overwash through the streets. That is a hardship, and it's an unnecessary hardship due to the fact. I'll keep going with it. As pointed out in staff's presentation, this is the regulation we are seeking a variance from. As Ms. Scoble pointed out, the two other resource agencies are to be consulted, but if you'll note, the question is whether or not the proposed design or installation will, and I've had that have that underlined, have an adverse impact on sea turtles. Will, as I looked it up in the dictionary, means inevitable. And staff's position on criteria one, they talk about concerns and possible negative effects. And those are based on wildlife and fisheries comments, but let's look at their comments. Wildlife says undetermined. Again, that's speculative. Impacts bales may have speculative. These resources, I can't. Sorry, I put some glasses on. These resources coastwide is unknown. Next highlighted portion. No information has been found regarding bale use on ocean shorelines in other states. They go on to say impacts bales may have, the cumulative impact they may have on repeat installations in the same area, the cumulative impact they may have on habitats. Not one of these expressed concerns are confirmed concerns, and the same is true for fisheries. They talk about bales due to the potential for the introduction of invasive species. And I note that the introduction of invasive species is not even part of the rule. Even if it were, this is a speculative concern. The same is true for the increase in the pH. They talk about potential changes. And then they state both types of bales may decompose rather quickly. And then they conclude insect introduction, again, which is not part of the rule, is unknown. And they say they bales may harbor insect nests or eggs. Those are the concerns that staff relied on in denying the permit. Not one of them is supported by a peer-reviewed scientific study. I respectfully submit to you that that does not constitute evidence that there will be an adverse impact on turtles or the other endangered species. Staff agrees with us on the third criteria, which includes that there is a hardship. We believe that the evidence shows that the hardship is unnecessary as well as peculiar to the property for the reasons I stated earlier. And may I indulge and ask for a few more minutes to get through this?
Sorry, Mr. Eads.
Yes, ma'am.
You've already got your extra time.
Yes, ma'am. I'll be quick. In November, Madam Chair, you directed staff to come back with amendments that allow the use of the hay bales. This is the actual recommendation to this body. Today, no camera permit applications for use of bales at sand fencings have been denied. At this time, DCM staff recommends maintaining the current minor permitting process. A fair reading of that to anybody would suggest apply for hay bales. That's what we did. After we applied, I think it's important to note that DCM staff asked us to include both pine and hay. So we agreed to do that. The fee rate permit, I just want to show the contrast. On June 3rd, 2016, June 3rd, 2016 p.m., Mr. Davis sent out figure eights application to the two agencies. 33 minutes later, I believe this is fisheries, say we don't have much more concern for these structures than regular sand fencing. 41 minutes after receiving that email, wildlife says we believe the idea could have merit, and they talk about the monitoring there, picture documentation, monthly, seasonal, etc., and a basic statement regarding bale decomposition. That's exactly what the town has approved. We have proposed the exact same monitoring that was good enough for figure eight. And since 2015 until today, February 23rd, 2023, the town has never received any peer-reviewed scientific studies that support the concerns expressed by the other regulatory agencies. We have Mr. Rosal cite seven studies, that's out of Exhibit 5. And lastly, I'll say we have been using Christmas trees on the coast for years. Fort Macon just ran an article that they've been doing it for 70 years. I did not see the difference between Christmas tree, a dead Christmas tree pine needles on the sand, or hay bales that were used with some degree of success at figure eight. I thank you for your time. I thank you for indulging me for going over. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Steve. Does anyone have any questions for either Christy or Ms. Reeves at this time?
If somebody can answer the question, you know, I see the concerns from people. There's a new tool in the box people are trying to utilize to be able to manage or try to maintain a volatile area. It's, but I think one of the facts, I don't think there would be any peer-reviewed research, is that if turtles are the main concern, is you've got to have the habitat for a turtle to lay eggs. I know last year down there in that same area, there was no habitat to lay some turtle eggs. This year, there may be potential for it. And if there's more tools in the box to be able to accomplish accumulating volumes of sand to prevent flooding, to slow down erosion, but the volume of sand is everything to be able to maintain that habitat. And if there's more tools in the box, especially with some supply chain, with other type of materials to be able to utilize the same accomplishment you're trying to do there. I guess the only question is, if there's not the habitat there, has there been any peer review that the sea turtles will go to a permanent sandbag area that's overwashed every day? I don't think you'll find any peer review to have that.
I'm not aware of the only scientific studies I'm aware of that bear on the issue of the impact of hay bales or pine bales are the seven studies cited by Mr. Rosal, senior biologist at CPE. Admittedly, they are not specifically about hay bales, but they are about dead vegetative debris that decomposes. The placement of these particular bags is far enough landward that it's traditionally not an area where turtles would nest to begin with. And as Ms. Goble pointed out, we were asked to call Mr. Steve Mercer after we filed our petition. In September of last year, your minutes reflect that he was referred to as someone with extensive knowledge and experience in the area of Doom Building. And fact 41, he concludes, and this is a letter he wrote to Mr. Whiteside, our discussion also led to the use of hay bales. I am in favor with the caveat of no grass bales. Commonly available wheat or oat straw with twine or clean pine straw with twine would be fine. Pine straw bales should not contain broom grass or broom sage. I thought the town of Ocean Isle Beach had been asked to try both types. That is someone that has been referred to as an expert in the area of Doom Building to this commission. We were asked to reach out to him about monitoring. That's what he said about hay bales. Again, we have proposed the exact same monitoring that was allowed for Figure 8. We proposed to place signage out there, and I think I can speak for the town, and certainly will agree to any condition that if there is any indicia that it's having a negative impact, we will remove it immediately.
Thank you.
Bob?
Yes, thank you. Could you describe for me any direct interaction you've had with the two agencies that have raised concerns about this project?
The town has not had any direct interaction. In fact, if you'll look at the stipulated exhibits, their request for interaction was to meet with VCM staff. The town, I think a fair reading of that will show the town's never been asked to sit down. The town is willing to sit down with them. And would have been willing to sit down with them prior to the permit denial. So that was never put on the table prior to the denial. They state to VCM after they say don't grant this permit that the agency should get together and talk. But the town's never been invited to such a meeting. We'd be happy to attend one.
But you could have asked for one. You could have asked for one. Since these are the agencies that have raised the objection, you could have said, well, let's get together about the plan.
Yes,
without waiting for an intervention.
Yes, sir. Absolutely, we could have. But the denial occurred, and they attach to the denial letter the agency's request to meet the DCM check. It was never pre-denial opportunity or even a suggestion that we do that.
But it was a pre-variance.
A post-variance application.
Pre-variance hearing.
So
it was what it was before. There was the opportunity to talk to them before they got asked this.
Yes, sir. And the staff reached out with them after we saw our variance. Mr. Whiteside just pointed out the same day that they received the comments back from the other agencies, the same day that they denied our permit. But again, I'm not going to deny that such a meeting could occur. Absolutely.
Mr.
Chair,
no, Bob covered it.
My question goes back to the presentation that Brendan provided. There's some photos that show a red line, you know, indicating like at the end of Shiloh Boulevard, a red line. Is that just the area where you're proposing these, or is that the configuration of?
That's the area.
Okay.
That would be, I can have Mr. Whiteside speak more specifically to the technical level, but there would be a minimum of an 8-foot gap, as Mr. Okay. pointed out, and it would be configured in the same configuration as traditional sand.
Okay. Thank you.
In the pictures that were shown of the flooding from Hurricane Ian,
yes, sir.
That same water that washed in on people's homes also covered sea turtle nests. Were there any studies done to determine how many nests were destroyed or had to be relocated as a result of Hurricane Ian? And is there any mitigation effects from using the straw as a sanitizer?
We didn't have any stipulated facts related to those questions.
I can ask staff
no,
if
we can't bring them in.
Okay, that's the question.
Can't bring them in.
Certainly believe that this is, in fact, our contention that the bale fencing would accumulate sand and mitigate that kind of the loss.
Other questions? If not,
consultation with Fish and Wildlife and Wildlife Resources Commission. They provided their input, and it would have made this much easier if the town had reached out to the agencies and come to us with a monitoring project that was jointly developed with those agencies. In the absence of that, it appears to me what we're being asked to do is to blow off those two agencies for them. That's just the way it feels to me.
Now, Tim, I think we have an opportunity here to approve the variance under condition that before any implementation of the plan, that consultation and interaction take place. That way, we don't have to come to hear this again. Either it happens or it doesn't happen. You know, I'd like to contend that the town of Ocean Isle Beach, as mentioned earlier by you, a model of trying to fight beach erosion and protect public property rights and do the right thing. And it appears to me that they've done exactly what I would have done based on the history that's available. And it's almost like they're being penalized, in my opinion, for trying to do the right thing. But I agree with you, Bob, there's that caveat. But I see an opportunity. They've already expressed willingness to have a monitoring program. How are we going to ever know if this works if somebody doesn't check it out? So I would make a motion on the first criteria to agree to the petition. Sure.
Before we get to motions, I have to agree with both of them. But I also look at this as possibly another tool in our toolbox. The availability of sand fencing, notwithstanding, for those of you that are on the ocean front, sand fencing works great when you first put it up. And then after that, you've got wire, you've got broken things. Children on the beach are always getting hurt with it. If we can find another mechanism, we'll never know until we try something. I listened to Mr. Mercer's thing about the hay bales or straw bales being bound with twine. When you're up in my area, somebody wanted to use old horsehair, braided horsehair that had fallen out. But something that's beyond metal that rusts, that cuts, that causes people to have to go to urgent cares all the time. But I think whatever we do, if we go forward, we need to have conditions with monitoring and involving those agencies that, in stipulated fact 17, saw no effects, and then you get further down, they start having concerns. But involve those agencies. And then this would determine how the Pleasure Commission goes and staff goes in further cases of something adding something to the toolbox.
So my question is, does the current variance request include a monitoring program?
That's a condition that we can. It does include a town monitoring, but it does not include Fish and Wildlife or Dr. Long from UNCW, which is one of those listed.
Right. Mr. Andrew, is the last stipulated fact 42 describes what they've proposed in connection with the variance for monitoring, which is similar to what figure 8 had been. So it would consist of picture documentation on a monthly, seasonal, and post-storm basis. They will likewise provide a statement regarding the status of bale decomposition. The aim of the monitoring will be to document bale effectiveness, material durability, and the bale's effort, bale fencing's effect on the surrounding habitat, and they also agreed if requested to erect signage that it was a pilot project.
Thank you.
Okay. Chief, if I may just, it's not so much identical to what Wildlife requested of figure 8.
Criteria 1 for the strict application of the applicable development rules, standards, orders issued by the commission.
so, the petitioner must identify the hardship and is aware of two different positions, one by petitioner and one by staff.
Well, I would like to make a motion that we adopt petitioner's view with a condition that we are monitoring, and that's where I need a little help. It sounds like what I heard is what they have proposed is going to provide monitoring, but I also understand the concern about buying in from Fish and Wildlife and the Wildlife Resources Commission, and I don't know quite how to handle that. And I would welcome any suggestions.
A lot of the conditions are put on at
Is there a second to the
motion?
Well, I have a condition. My motion is. Well, criteria four.
I would go with the monitoring program. Town of Ocean Isle Beach has proposed, with the addition that if there's any evidence of harmful side effects to turtle nesting or other creatures, that they be removed.
I wonder if we could kind of cover all the bases by also requiring that at least there be a consultation with the two agencies and that the town consider any further input from those two agencies. Not obligate the town to at least meet face to face and consider any additional concerns that the agencies have.
I can live with that and know the town, I'm sure they'll do that. So yeah.
I second the motion.
I just point out, as a successful discussion, that it was pointed out yesterday the good relationship between the town's engineering firm and the Corps of Engineers. So I feel like they have that relationship already established, and that that's part of that thing that they, I'm sure that they would consult each other. Typically, Fish and Wildlife or Wildlife Resources or Corps of Engineers, they all kind of work together, so that relationship sort of established, and there's a communication area that's already developed. Any other discussion?
Can you just clarify that the motion is as amended by Bob and then seconded by Neil? Is that correct?
Yes.
And now I'm going to put you on the spot and get a restatement of the combination of what's being proposed here.
Actually, I thought
I can do that. So I move that we adopt petitioner's position with the condition that they will do a monitoring program that they have presented. In addition to that, there will be a stipulation that there is any evidence found that there is negative impact on the protected species, that they will be removed, and that there will be a consultation with Fish and Wildlife and the Wildlife Resources Commission to hear their concerns, but not be bound by their concerns. Some of that?
I said consider.
Consider. You got that?
Sorry, I'm maintaining my second.
You good, Larry?
No, I'm just waiting for discussion.
Any further discussion?
Could we raise a point of clarification?
Okay.
So, action. Well, we have to implement the permit. We need to know when the condition satisfies. We just want to talk about what it means. And
has the vote been taken already?
No, it's discussion. Yeah. Motion is second.
What?
Based on the motion, I think those conditions have to be met. The consultation would have to occur before the permit is issued.
That's what I wanted to ask about.
Is that not?
I would think.
Yeah. Yes. I would think that the consultations have to occur before the permit is issued. But the monitoring, any further action is ongoing. It's ongoing. That answers your question. And however the time.
It wasn't about the time.
Is it the town's best interest to schedule the consultation sooner rather than later? Do they want the permit as quickly as possible?
I think we understand it the way it's written. The way it's presented, so I think we're good.
Madam Chair, I assure you the town's if we're fortunate enough to get the variance granted, we'll reach out to those agencies immediately. My only concern is we can't control their schedules or how quickly they get back to us.
If there's a problem, I'm sure staff will let us know.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So they're monitoring. Do they have to report the results of the monitoring to anyone in particular, or are they just monitoring?
They report the results of the monitoring to coastal management staff. That's the only way we're going to learn how it goes.
I would like to approach and have a little conversation about this, but there's an objection, so I don't want to.
I'm all for openness and illuminating it, but I don't know what you're going to say, Mr. Davis. And I just would like the opportunity to put my two cents in if needed. But by all means, I'm not trying to commandeer this proceeding.
Actually, if you want to ask a question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and by all means, please. I just want some clarity on exactly, and I think that question kind of leads into trying to think this through, and I think the motion was that the monitoring is not bound by the consultation with Fish and Wildlife Service and Wildlife Resources Commission, and so it's more tied to those impacts that might happen. From what I recall, some of the additional monitoring that the resource agencies were interested in were more destructive sampling of the dunes that might be created, and temperature monitoring. And so if the monitoring results are being provided to DCM, we would then I presume take those monitoring results to Fish and Wildlife and WRC to determine impacts. But the motion is that the monitoring is not bound by the consultation. So I'm just caught in a little bit of a loop of when do we impose removal, when do we require removal under this, and how much are we bound by the consultation? So it's really just trying to understand the process.
My thought would be if we approve this, that there's going to be consultation to those areas. If the town agrees with what they asked to do, that becomes part of the monitoring program. If they don't, it doesn't.
Okay.
And monitoring is an ongoing process, so you're not going to. It'll take you a while monitoring to determine the impacts. And I'm sure the town is going to post those impacts. They've been really good about posting everything on their online stuff. It'll be available to the public as well as they'll report by 2 minutes.
Can we also have clarification on the time frame for reporting to DCM? Is that on a yearly basis?
Monthly.
Madam Chair, we propose and would agree to a condition of monthly reporting, and we would likewise agree to posting those monitoring.
It was monthly in the stipulated facts.
Yes, ma'am.
That's
and we would likewise agree to posting that monitoring on our website as a condition if the commission sees it.
Thank you. I mean, I was going about the stipulated fact of monthly.
Yes, ma'am.
Any further discussion on certain criteria? If not, all in favor? All opposed? Motion is carried. Next up, criteria.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to move that we approve the position of the petition.
I'll second that. Motion by Commissioner Norris, second by Commissioner Bolton.
the hardships result from actions taken by the petitioner. This is the criteria that both petitioner and staff agree in the same position. So, election of criteria 3.
On criteria 3, I would move to accept petitioner's position.
As well as staff's.
Oh, yes, they would accept the
same. Yes,
they
would. Yes, they
would. Yes, they would. Corrected on that.
Any further discussion? All in favor? All opposed? Criteria 3 is passed. Criteria 4. Will the variance requested by the petitioner be consistent with the spirit, purpose, and intent of the rules, standards, and orders issued by the commission, secure the public welfare and safety, and preserve substantial justice? There are two different positions. Is there a motion on criteria 4?
Chairman, I will move this business to adopt the position of the petition.
Second. Second by Commissioner Littles. Any further discussion? This will be the time if anybody's got any other conditions to say so. And Commissioner Norris pretty well succeeded with his initiative. If not, all in favor of the motion? All opposed?
Madam Chair and Commission, I thank you for your time and consideration.
I would like to request that we have a report to the commission of the first exam on the results of the monitoring.
I would put it after the consultations that occur and then put it upon it and then install it. I would like just to receive the reports.
And the appropriate time for our
absolutely. Not monthly. We'll get a consultation every month in the courts sent right. To us. Okay. As well as on the field for the public.
Well, it's two different issues, so, but one I wanted to sum up. I didn't know if Braxton wanted to speak first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Sorry.
This 1 15-minute window to get your comments in on this. If there's rulemaking, anytime there's rulemaking, there is fiscal analysis, there's public comment period, there's additional public hearing, and so it's a lengthy process. So I want to assure you that this isn't the only time in this 15-minute comment period, which is a standard part of a commission public input session. So that was one thing I wanted to point out. Also, I've read every single letter, really appreciate them, heartfelt comments on the inlet hazard area rules in particular. I did want to say there are a couple things in there. One is a number of folks have brought up the issue of the original fiscal analysis that's required as part of state rulemaking, that the proposed impacts of the rule exceed a $1 million threshold of potential impacts, and that then triggers a different level of fiscal analysis. Those comments came actually to the last meeting of the commission as well. And we took that to heart. We went back and had already been talking about that with the agency that oversees that process of the fiscal analysis review, the Office of State Budget and Management. And so we had already determined that we were going to revise that into, I think it's called a substantive impacts fiscal analysis. So that work is underway. It was kind of late-breaking after mail out, so wanted to reassure you, if part of your comment was going to be on that, we are addressing that already. I'd be very interested in hearing. We had a number of comments that came in on inlet hazard areas that said that the fact that your property is within the boundaries of an inlet hazard area is impacting insurance rates. Very interested in that. Never have seen that before. There were a number of folks that mentioned that there was actually a checkbox on insurance forms as to whether there was an inlet hazard area. If anyone could, we've not seen any evidence of that. Inlet hazard areas have been in place since 1978. And so we just want to know that. As part of our fiscal analysis, we need to understand if there are actually insurance implications. I'm not aware of any, and I've never seen any form, and our staff have tried to reach out and look into it, but we just haven't found it. So if anybody has evidence of it, please provide that to us and let us know what you're seeing on that front. Another public comment that came in suggested that the inlet hazard area prevents beach renourishment. That's not the case, just to let you know. And that's it. I just wanted to try to clear a few things up if it helps for the public comment here. Thank you.
Justin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did sign up for two separate issues, but with Braxton's clarification, I'm going to try to sum it up into 3 minutes and 2 seconds. So the first issue is, again, I'm Justin Whiteside of the town of Ocean Isle Beach. You did receive both of our letters. The first one dealt with the fiscal analysis. We thank staff for seeing the substantial economic impact, I think is referred to in the statute. So going back and seeing that it's over that $1 million threshold. The other issue, as far as the inlet hazard area boundary updates, is the age of this data. It was compiled in 2019, so I would assume a lot of that data was compiled early in 2019, probably also in 2018. We had a global pandemic that kind of stopped the world, but it increased building. So a lot of these beaches and along the coast have had an economic and building boom, so a lot of that data is going to be outdated. So if it is not updated, we're going to be relying on data that's 10 years old by the time we implement it and then have a five-year update. So we just ask that that be updated. The other item I had was on a rule that, in my apologies, I didn't know it was already approved. I thought it was wrapped up in the inlet hazard rules, but it's 07H-0308B that deals with dune reconstruction. I'm trying to find the title. But it's basically for the creation of dunes. With the current amended rule, no new dunes are allowed within the inlet hazard areas. With the proposed inlet hazard area, it will be an increase in 112 acres of Ocean Isle Beach. So if we don't allow new dunes in those areas, you're taking away a tool in the toolbox from 85 additional structures, and that's based on 2019 staff data from that fiscal analysis. We've talked about sandbags. We talked about groins. We'd like to have the building of dunes to be another tool for protection for these property owners. At least some staff has indicated that allowing these new dunes within the IHA would give property owners a false sense of protection. Although this may be true in some instances, any concerns outweighed by the value of the protection these dunes can provide. New dunes are no different than any federal, state, or local beach nourishment project that deposits new sand on the beach, strands are widened, and provides storm protection. So seeing a dune out there and seeing that it's 500 feet wide, they're kind of one and the same. Also, the town feels that this could place the way the rule is written that allows dunes to be restored or repaired or rebuilt could be an undue burden on the applicant trying to reconstruct the previous existing dune system. We applaud staff and how they try to implement things fairly across the whole coast, but we've got different LPOs, we've got different field offices, so how does the applicant prove that a dune existed, and then will there be a size limitation on that dune? This leaves a lot of room for interpretation between staff, local LPOs, and applicants. So again, we ask that you direct staff to include new dunes to be allowed consistently within IHA, OEA.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Robertson. I'm speaking as president of the Ocean Isle Property Owners Association. We represent nearly 1,500 owners in Ocean Isle Beach. And I'll keep this brief because I just would like to reiterate a point that you've already read in the resolution that was submitted by the Ocean Isle Property Owners Association back on November the 10th of last year, where we feel strongly that any maps being used to draw the new inland hazard area boundaries should be very, very current. As you had a chance to see yesterday, the east end of Ocean Isle Beach has had recently installed a highly engineered, specifically designed terminal groin, and some of the overhead views, as we saw earlier today also, show that the new terminal groin in conjunction with the ongoing storm damage reduction project has drastically improved the topography of that area. And we think these things should be considered when the new boundaries are drawn. Thank you again for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. Chairman Cheek.
Good morning, Madam Chair and CRC members. Thank you so much for letting me speak to you. My name is Cherry Cheek. I reside at 27 Craven Street on Ocean Isle Beach. Foremost, I want to welcome you to our area. I am here to address the inland hazard maps and preceding several other people who are going to make points about the inland hazard. The proposed boundaries and setback factors affect many homes and properties in Brunswick County. Times have changed, factors affecting the inlets have changed. The natural accretion, beach renourishment, and construction of the terminal groin have not been taken into account under the newly proposed maps. These factors change the calculations and the erosion rates of the inlets. The consideration of these factors would alter the data used to set the IHA boundaries. The maps do not change the dynamics of the nature, but they do affect the property rights of our taxpaying citizens. The science panel report included a recommendation of an update of the inlet shoreline study every 5 years, which has not been done. The tax repercussions to the towns and to our county are huge. There are so many property owners and even elected officials that are not aware of the rules, the maps, and surprisingly, many of them didn't know what CRC was. This brings a concern of the ability of said property owners to be able to comment and give input to the rules that will impact their homes, their livelihood, and their investment in our community. I'm here to simply ask you to please delay decisions until updated studies can be performed, notification can be sent to the public, and individually to the affected property owners. Public forums can be held, and realistic decisions can be made regarding this impact of our citizens' lives. And I thank you so much. And just real quick, I know in Beaufort we had the opportunity to hear about an educational process that y'all were starting in Mesa Brown. I think that from what we all saw yesterday at the groin, that would be awesome to put that into that educational realm of what y'all may be working on.
Thank you. Steve Johnson.
Morning, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. If you remember, I spoke at the November meeting, gave a quick statistics lesson. I also sent in a letter. I hope you all have the opportunity to read that and go through everything. I did want to take the time today to really speak about this flawed IHAM. Right, so it's the method that really is a huge issue as we're setting on these rules. So I'd like to remind you, right, that the rule 150B-19.1 calls for rules that are based on sound scientific information. Right? The linchpin of the method relies on simple linear regression to determine the linear regression rate of shoreline change on page 17. Page 8 of the same report details out 9 specific significant factors affecting shoreline change. Tide, wind, current, waves, dredging, nourishment, inlet change, or closure and relocation, and here's the big one to me, you saw it yesterday, erosion control structures. That statement alone nullifies the use of simple linear regression as a forecasting model. Right? The phone report says 9 specific significant factors. Right? A scientific model would incorporate all these significant factors into that model. A tool exists. Right? It's called multiple linear regression. Nowhere in the method is multiple linear regression employed. And you saw the drawing yesterday. No doubt you saw the pictures. Change has definitely occurred. Don't you think that in the method, significant factors of that change should be incorporated? It absolutely makes sense. Instead, the method just wrapped all these significant factors, ignores them, and looks at time, erroneously leveraging extrapolation to model future state. Now, in the letter, I cite a whole bunch of sources. We went over this last time. We don't need to do it again. But extrapolation does not work. It's not scientifically sound. Again, violation 150B.19.1. Section 2.6 in the report admits that, quote, some elements require additional modification based off how well computed IHA fit the unique characters of each inlet. In essence, the panel overwrote the scientific model with their opinion. Again, a violation of the scientific rule. It's a tacit admission that the model does not work. Right. So in conclusion, right, given the unscientific nature of the method and the resultant inflating setback factors that everybody's going to talk about and how it affects them, right, the revised IHA should not be adopted until we have a scientific method that implements it. Thank you for the time.
Good morning. My name is Kyle Myers. I'm the president of the Holden Beach Property Owners Association. In January of 2010, our members passed a resolution objecting to the changes in the hazard area on Holden Beach. 3 years later, we still have the fundamental same objection, that the inland hazard area method does not accurately reflect the trends on our accreting shorelines. The consequence for Holden Beach is that the new inland hazard area will direct development away from what has always been one of the least risk parts of our island. This is completely contrary to the intent of protecting properties by minimizing the likelihood of loss in vulnerable areas. The geology and morphology of the island clearly shows that the Shiloh Inlet is not migrating east. There's pictures and data that prove this going back to when the intercoastal waterway was created. The west end of Holden Beach has never lost the structure to erosion, ever. The portion of the inlet hazard area that's being added has never been renourished and it's been accretional for recorded history. The properties in the 900-1,100 blocks that are being added to the inlet hazard area typically command a higher value due to the accretion. The broader beach strand and the deep dune field. So the impact of flagging these as hazardous and placing restrictions on them will have a significant impact on our tax base. And that will affect all property owners on Holden Beach. In Braxton, they're flagged. We do have a checkbox that's on our elevation certificates that checks if it's in an inlet hazard area. Mm-hmm. Holden Beach has a robust shoreline management plan that includes extensive renourishment. In addition to the regular placement of inlet sand on the east end of our beach, in 2017 we placed 1.3 million cubic yards of sand on the central portion of the island. And last year we placed an additional 1.5 million cubic yards in the same area. I live in the middle of the island, and in the past 6 years of dry sand beach in front of my house has moved seaward by hundreds of feet. Much of this new sand will migrate west due to the longshore currents. The IHAM method, if it doesn't accurately consider the impact of these renourishment efforts, continues to treat accretion the same as erosion by only looking at the standard deviation of shoreline change, then the result of our renourishment efforts will be to expand the inlet hazard area even further eastward as the downdrift portion of the island continues to pick up this new sand. It's now been more than 6 years since the original analysis was completed, which was done prior to the two major renourishment efforts we've undertaken. We're requesting that you please conduct a 5-year update and hold off on implementing anything until that update has been completed and the analysis is considered. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Is it being very verbal?
never heard about this. I never gotten a letter from the CRC, our municipality. We understand it. No, we never heard. We heard by word of mouth. So we're playing a little catch up, and I apologize for that. But, you know, there's a lot of issues here. We heard Mr. Whiteside, Mr. Robinson, Ms. Cheek, they talked about the maps. Had a lot of problem with the maps. As you know, if we're on the West End, it's dynamic. Mr. Johnson just outlined the issues of science and methodology problems. But let's talk about the financial problems. I'll give you an example. 2015, the house next door to me burned to the ground in 8 minutes, Halloween night. That house would not be able to be rebuilt under the present Inland Hazard Area laws you're proposing. Now, my house had $150,000 worth of damage as the one next door, the way the wind blew. If we do what you're proposing, my house is going to be worth probably half of what it was worth, as is all of the other people. Now I now have a quarter of the amount of money to fix my house. So somebody could have had their house burned down next door to me, and I no longer have a house. And a lot of people in our area are second home people, or they live there. I live there. There are a lot of people in my little seven house neighborhood. Nobody rents except for two people. These are people that come here, they're second homes, this is their livelihood, they've worked for this their whole lives, and now they're getting told, oh, this wasn't a part of the law when you bought the house, but now we're going to retroactively apply this to you. You know, this is a serious issue. We all understand when we buy a house on the beach, there are potentials for vulnerability and things of that nature, but it doesn't mean that we're going to have our property taken away from us. I mean, this is akin to a taking. It's not much different than North Carolina DOT coming in and saying in 3 years we're putting this highway in, and now the people can't sell their house. How are they going to finance the house? I mean, there's all these issues that really need to be dealt with, and now I've just heard for the first time you can't put a dune in to protect your property in this situation. Again, these are all major factors to consider. That it's these people's livelihood. It isn't a theory. It's our nest eggs. We've been blessed to buy a house on the beach, but if we can't keep it, how are we supposed to live here? So we really hope that this is going to be taken seriously. We'll be giving further comments down the road, and we very much appreciate your comments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Margaret Bishop. Folks, I'm sorry. I'll let you go, then I skip somebody. Please.
Good morning. Margaret Rudd Bishop. I own a real estate business on Oak Island. I was licensed in 1973. So when these inlet hazard area maps first came into place in 1979, I remember that. I was aware of it. But I can tell you, I took my Express 350 van yesterday, and day before yesterday, and stuck it up in a gravel parking lot. And I called AAA. I felt sure they would save me. They said, ma'am, we don't cover 350s. I said, you've got to be kidding. And I hung up, and I felt ambushed. I've been paying for years. So here we have a new inlet hazard area map that on Oak Island takes in King's Lynn all the way up, looks like short of Blue Water Point, first, second row. This is a third row in there. These people bought real estate from me, and I told them it was a great place to invest, a great place to vacation, a great place to live. I feel that these people, if they don't receive direct notification, and you know they're not hard to find because they pay taxes, so we can use the tax records to see who's affected by these new proposed rules. And in fact, I hope that the studies are updated that lead you to place new burdens on property owners. People that are affected, it will certainly reduce their investment value, which will reduce their tax valuation, and then it will reduce the tax base, which will cause the taxes to go up for all the other property owners. I just beg you to please take no action without more study on the inlet hazard area as it applies to Lockwood Folly Inlet, which it directly affects the west end of Oak Island. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Daisy, I'm sorry, Daisy.
It's all right. Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the Commission. Daisy, I'm the town administrator of the town of Oak Island Beach.
Again, we thank you for visiting Ocean Beach. We hope you all enjoyed your visit to our terminal groin. And you saw firsthand the benefits our terminal groin has provided thus far. We appreciate the work being done by the Commission on the inlet hazard area rules, especially today with the grandfathering rule. We appreciate that. We encourage the Commission to continue to study this information, particularly the age of the current physical analysis. Thank you, Braxton, for your comments regarding this update and the information provided regarding the $1 million threshold will be reviewed. We understand the updated inlet hazard area has been going on for quite some time, but we implore the Commission to address these items that have been mentioned today before adopting these rules. If these rules are adopted by this summer, as we have been told, these maps will be approximately 4 years old. Your staff is proposing updating these boundaries every 5 years. We implore you to update this information prior to adoption so that we can all agree the rules and the maps are indicative of the most recent information available. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Good morning. Almost afternoon. I'm not going to reiterate what everybody said much more eloquently than I would have said it, but I have written a letter to you and in my opposition to this proposal. We have had so much wonderful sand on the east end. The groin has been remarkable. The town has put in so much money and effort, and your proposal is not a good one. I mean, it's going to be detrimental to the homes on the east end as well as all the beaches on the coast. So I would like to ask for you to, I'm sure you didn't intentionally do this, but hopefully you'll hear what everyone is saying and their feelings about it. They've tried to mitigate the erosion and every other problem that they have. So I'm asking for you to have thoughts about not adopting this proposal and thinking about all the homeowners and all the detrimental effects that this will have on everybody.
Thank you. Julie Donovan?
Hi, Madam Chair, Commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Julie Youngman, Southern Environmental Law Center, and I'm briefly not speaking about inlet hazard areas. I'm just talking about the septic rules that are a 3 o'clock item on your agenda, and I'm just generally speaking in favor of them. I work with a lot of groups around and constituents around the state that care a lot about protecting natural resources and really care about preserving and protecting the state's beautiful beaches and barrier islands. As we heard, I think, in great detail in September, erosion is happening, there's no denying it. Sea level rise, longshore currents, high tides, et cetera, are eroding the beaches to the point that there's a lot of infrastructure, human-built infrastructure close to the beach, and it's a real problem when septic systems fail. And I just wanted to commend your staff on doing a great job of finding the holes in the existing statutes and plugging them in with some really good proposed rules. We did submit comments yesterday with, you know, minor technical suggestions for adding clarity, but I think those are really going to be an important gap filler, and we really support the point of CAMO, which is to provide a program for the protection, preservation, and orderly development and management of the North Carolina coast. And I think these rules are real important to address the problem that has just begun to happen and is going to keep happening with failing septic systems, causing real problems for people on the beach.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Todd, I'll see you back. Good morning, Madam Chair, fellow commissioners. My name is Todd Ressler. I'm from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm here to talk about the proposed inlet hazard rules. I'd like to start off and thank Braxton and Division of Coastal Management for recognizing that the fiscal analysis needs to be looked at again. I think these rules do have a number of substantial economic impacts on the coast, and it's important to get that fiscal analysis right. A lot of the comments that I'm going to say today I've already included in written comments and been talked about today. The two I want to focus on are the boundaries proposed inlet hazard areas. And really what we're looking at is that the science panel recommended that these be updated every 5 years. We're now looking at, you know, a 2019 report. This was based on, I'm assuming, data that was pre-2019. So we're approaching that five-year update. And I think it's important that if these rules get adopted, that those boundaries get looked at again before these rules are finalized. I'm not a statistics expert, so I can't talk to you about linear regression, standard deviation, but it sounds like you need a statistics expert on the science panel. That needs to be looked at, that those methods. One other thing I wanted to mention was that there's kind of a black box in this rule. You have the statistics that some people understand, and that is a science. But you also have the science panel's professional knowledge. You know, looking at erosion control structures, dredging, renourishment, natural processes, that's really unknown what was considered in this rule. What kind of professional knowledge did they apply in defining these boundaries? And I think we need to understand that. We also need to update that information. As we talked about today, Ocean Isle Beach recently installed a terminal groin. That was not considered when these boundaries were drawn. Looking at Carolina Beach Inlet is another example. That is now dredged regularly by the town and the state using funds from the Shallow Draft Fund. A lot of our inlets on our coast are dynamic. I agree with that. But they're also managed, and that process needs to be considered in these rules. The final thing that I want to mention is the structure size. Looking at the exception in 0.0309B, you don't meet the new setbacks. You can fall back and look at the existing setbacks that predated rules. Those structure sizes are limited to 2,000 feet, though. Currently, you're allowed to build up to 5,000 square feet. If that's not changed, what you're really doing is you're encouraging development. For lots that aren't developed and are allowed to develop up to 5,000 square feet, what you're going to see is you're going to see a rush of chamominer permits that are submitted to build those houses. Those lots will be built sooner if that structure size is not looked at. So I would encourage you to look at that exception and consider increasing that structure limit size to 5,000 square feet. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. That is the end of the silent speech. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to a public comment? Seeing none, there is no speech. Next up, and some of the report of the rules of the commission.
Thank you very much. Angela's going to be helping me right now by putting up a PowerPoint. And the first matter of business is to go into closed session so that we can discuss what happened here.
Madam Chair, I move that the commission go into closed session pursuant to North Carolina General Statute Section 143-318.11A3. Consultant's attorney regarding confidential options and responsible rules of use and necessary.
Good job,
No, just get the car key.
I've never heard of these.
I'm
assuming your name. Yeah. Angela, of course. Yes. Good. And anybody else you think from staff should be here? I don't know if you want Jonathan or.
Yeah,
they're welcome to attend.